I will now move on to introducing the members of our technical panel, of our technical update panel. One of whom is fleeing the stage, which is a little alarming, but I'm sure it will all work out in the end. The first person that I will introduce is Neely Shaw. I am delighted to welcome Neely to this event. As Hans said, she joined us not quite a year ago, so this is her first appearance at the World Standard Setters, although she may be a familiar face to some of you if you worked with her in one of her previous capacities, either when she was at the U.S. Security and Exchange Commission, did a lot of work with foreign private issuers there, which built on her experience as an auditor working not only in the U.S., but also based in Europe, again, with foreign private issuers. So Neely has been in her role for just under a year and really has been a tremendous addition to our staff. The next person I'm going to introduce, I think this is order of speaking, though not order of sitting, is Henry Rees. Henry is a very familiar and respected face for this crowd. He has been with the organization for a number of years, and many of you will know him from his leadership role on both IFRS 15 revenue and IFRS 16 leases. When those two were issued, he did not abandon them, but shifted gears into implementation support role, which has been a very consuming role, along with oversight of education. Now, to Henry's right is Peter Clark. Again, a face that needs no introduction for anybody who has been around the ISB at all. I think Peter knows more of the standards, having written parts or all of many of them in his, I think it's over 20 years with the organization and its predecessors. Most recently, Peter threw his heart and soul into the conceptual framework project at the same time as he took over as a director on our research work. So Peter is going to speak about those roles. And then to Peter's right, last but certainly not least, Kumar Dasgupta. Kumar is yet another familiar face, and he has a very consistent message. Financial instruments are the rulers of the world. With IFRS 9 mandatory this year, Kumar is not kicking back and wondering what to do to fill his time. Instead, he has been the director responsible for not only our financial instruments with characteristics of equity, but also our projects on dynamic risk management and work that we're doing right now on IBOR. And I'm sure he'll explain what that is and what we're doing about it. So with that, let me turn over to Neely to kick off the technical update session.
Okay, well thank you, Mary. Thank you for the kind introduction. Tomorrow actually is my 1 year anniversary, so I am absolutely delighted to be here. I'm very much looking forward to meeting as many of you as possible, so please do come find me during the breaks and I'll be mingling around at lunch and dinner as well. So today what we'll cover in this ISB update are a number of things sort of at the 50,000 foot level, and then there are breakout sessions throughout the conference where we'll dig into some more of the details. I'll be starting off by giving you an overview of the achievements for the past year, as well as some things to look forward to over the coming months. And then I'll dig into our flagship project on better communications. And then I'll turn things over to Peter and Kumar to talk about active projects, and then to Henry to cover our activities in supporting implementation of the new standards, as well as some not-so-new standards, as well as the IFRS for SME standard. And then finally, I'll wrap up talking a little bit about our technology initiative, which isn't something officially on our technical work plan, but it's a cross-cutting initiative that affects us as a standard setter, and we wanted to make sure you were familiar with it. So starting off with our major activities and achievements over the last year, I think as a standard setter, as you all know, one of our key performance indicators is the issuance of high-quality documents. And as others have already mentioned, most significantly was our issuance of the conceptual framework in March of this year. It is effective immediately, and I am not going to say anything further on the topic because this is really the centerpiece of this year's conference. We have a number of great panels on the conceptual framework, as well as some breakout sessions that will be giving you a chance to apply the conceptual framework to some case studies on crypto assets and variable and contingent consideration. So very much look forward to your thoughts on that. Looking forward, we have a couple of amendments coming up. The first is the definition of a business, which will be issued later this month, and then definition of material, the clarifications, which will be issued in November of this year. Both of those documents will be effective in 2020 with early application permitted. And then on the right-hand side of the screen, you'll see some consultation documents that are either in process or anticipated. So as Hans mentioned, FICE was issued towards the end of June of this year with a 180-day comment period. So please do, if you haven't already started looking at it, please do take a look. We would very much love to hear from you. The comment deadline there is January 7th. We also anticipate in December issuing an exposure draft on the costs associated with onerous contracts. So this is IAS 37 amendments. And we expect to have a 120-day comment period on that. And then last but not least, we issued in September, so just a few weeks ago, a proposed taxonomy update on common practice elements arising from IFRS 13. I'll explain a little bit more about what that is for those of you that aren't quite involved in the taxonomy. But the deadline here and the key piece is that it's coming up very soon on the 19th of November. So digging down a little bit more, conceptual framework, as I mentioned, I don't need to express how important that is. We as standard setters all know it underpins what we do every day. And I will leave it to the other speakers at this conference to give you some more information on that. What I wanted to spend a little bit more time on is some upcoming consultations. As you can see on this slide, there is quite a bit coming through in 2019. And what we are trying very hard to do is manage that tricky balance between making sure we don't overload the system, because we very much want to hear from our stakeholders, we very much want your feedback, and yet at the same time keeping these projects moving forward, because the faster that we can get these projects to a final state, the sooner that investors can start realizing the benefits of the improved standards. So a couple of things to help you with your planning. As Hans had mentioned, one of the things we're looking at very carefully is our timelines. We want very much to be able to give you more definitive dates as to when we're going to be issuing these consultation documents so that you can do your planning. The other thing to reassure you is that all of these documents will have, at a minimum, 120-day comment period, although in some cases, FICE being an example, we have gone up to 180 days. The other things just to flag for you is that with dynamic risk management, what we're issuing there as a consultation document is really a lighter touch consultation. It's really just putting forth a core model to test the waters, to see that if this core model has legs, then the staff can go back and dig into some more of the details and develop some more of the thinking around the details. And Kumar will talk a little bit more about that. The other thing I'll highlight on this slide is primary financial statements. If you followed our meeting, board meeting just a couple weeks ago, we've moved primary financial statements from the research work plan to a standard setting project. The question still to determine is whether the board will be issuing a discussion paper or an exposure draft as the consultation document. And depending on that question, as well as the remaining deliberations, there's a possibility that the time frame might slip a little bit. Certainly, as you can imagine, with issuing an exposure draft, there's a little bit more work that needs to go through in getting the precision of the words, a little bit more research that may take some time. So, to be determined, but I just wanted to flag that to help you with your planning. And with that, I'm going to move into our flagship project on better communications in financial reporting. This project, as you can tell by the title, is really focusing on providing effective and clear communication to investors. It's something that arose from the 2015 agenda consultation, where investors really wanted us to prioritize issues that matter to them, and one of those issues is poor quality presentation in the financial reports. Within this project. There are actually four sub-projects, or four legs to it. On the top part of the slide, you'll see three of the projects relate to the content of financial reports. So that's PFS, Disclosure Initiative, and Management Commentary. And then the final piece is the delivery of those financial reports, which is the IFRS taxonomy. And I'll go through each of these just at a very high level. Again, there is a breakout session later today, and then I believe it's repeated. So they'll go through these projects in more detail. But starting off with primary financial statements, this project is focusing on targeted improvements to the financial statements, most significantly the statement of performance. What it's looking at is improving the content and the structure of the financial statements. So this could be in a number of different ways, including the addition of more subtotals on the statement of performance, additional line items, additional disaggregation, and removal of optionality. The other thing that this project is exploring is management performance measures, which goes by different names, so alternative performance measures, non-GAAP measures. And what the board is working through is that, again, that perfect balance between giving management the opportunity to tell their story, having flexibility in the financial statements so that they are relevant to users, but at the same time instilling discipline so that there is comparability and transparency for the user. And the way that the board has tentatively decided to do that is by allowing the disclosure of management performance measures, but having them be reconciled back to additional mandatory subtotals that they've tentatively decided to require on the face of the statement of performance. So that reconciliation gives users additional insight, additional transparency. If they agree with the reconciling items, great. If they don't, they can make necessary adjustments. In addition, that reconciliation would be coupled with a number of additional disclosures, including things like how that management performance measure is useful to investors and how management uses it, making sure there's clear labeling of the reconciling items, and disclosure of how those reconciling items have been calculated. As I mentioned, the focus is primarily on the statement of performance. We really don't have a lot planned for the statement of financial position, although the board is going to be working through some templates which might affect the statement of financial position, as well as some guidance on disaggregation, which may have a consequence as well. And then with respect to the statement of changes in equity, I will leave that to Kumar to talk about the FIES project, which will have some implications for that statement. So that was the first piece of the Better Communications project. The second piece relates to the Disclosure Initiative project. And this piece also is driven to content of the financial reports, particularly what's inside the financial reports. And what the board is looking at here is addressing three of the concerns that we've heard about disclosures. One, that there's not enough relevant information. Two, that there's too much irrelevant information, and then three, that that information is being ineffectively communicated. With the Disclosure Initiative, there are a number of sub-projects. So if you've been following this carefully, you'll see that this project has sort of shifted and spun off into baby projects, and I'll try to explain that a little bit. By focusing primarily on the four boxes in the middle, the case studies, the feedback statement, materiality practice statement, and the targeted standards level review. Those four projects are tied directly or indirectly to the board's discussion paper on principles of disclosure, which was issued in March of 2017. And one of the pieces of feedback that we received in the course of that discussion paper is that the board is tackling a number of different things of varying levels of significance. And so what stakeholders were looking for was a little bit more structure, a little bit more prioritization, a little bit more understanding around how all of the ideas within that POD discussion paper related to the board's other projects. So the board went through and worked through that in March of 2018. And I'll come through and walk you through sort of how each of those elements of the discussion paper has spun off or been addressed in the board's decision making. Before I do that, just one little piece. As I mentioned, there is aspects of the work in Disclosure Initiative that's sort of indirectly tied to principles of disclosure. And these case studies that were issued in October of 2017 is one example. Hans touched on it in his opening remarks. These case studies illustrate the 7 principles for better communication that the discussion paper put forth back in March of last year. The other thing that these case studies do is talk about the process that some of these companies went through to improve their disclosures. And I think the important takeaway here is that even though our Better Communications project is still underway, even though there's still a number of projects that we have to finalize, today companies can improve their disclosures. There are things that one can do on their own to communicate better with investors. So we don't need to wait for everything to be completed. But as I mentioned, principles of disclosure. So how is that being progressed forward? The discussion paper, as I said, was issued in March of 2017. And one of the most significant pieces coming out of that is the desire to improve how standards are developed and drafted. And as a result of that, the board has taken on a new project for targeted standards level review of disclosures. And very shortly, I'll talk a little bit more about that. The other thing that came out of the discussion paper is a desire to develop guidance to help entities disclose which accounting policies to disclose. So what is a material accounting policy? The board will be taking that on as well in the future, and I'll touch on that in just a few minutes. There were also a number of pieces of that POD discussion paper that related to primary financial statements, so things around disclosure or presentation of an EBITDA subtotal. Those questions have been moved over to the Primary Financial Statements Project and will be dealt with there in future meetings. And then there were a number of issues that were determined to really not get a lot of bang for the buck. These were sort of low priority questions about formatting. Do we provide guidance on the location of disclosures? Do we think through the location of principles versus objectives? Do we think through provision of non-IFRS information in the financial statements and the flip, IFRS financial information outside the financial statements? The board determined all of that as sort of a lower priority, not gonna get significant improvements for disclosures, and so they've taken those off the table. And all of that will be discussed in a feedback statement that the board is working, or excuse me, that the staff is working on right now. So as I mentioned, one of the main pieces coming out of the POD discussion paper is a project on targeted standards level review of disclosures. And this project is intended to help stakeholders improve the usefulness of their disclosures. Now, a consequence of this project may be a reduction in the volume of disclosures, but that is not the intent of the project. That is not the primary goal, and it's something that preparers may sort of feel like should be the thrust, but that's not what we're hearing from users. In order to do this targeted standards level review, the board has identified 2 standards, IS 19 and IFRS 13, in which it will test some draft guidance that it has developed on developing standards. And there's going to be an iterative process where the board has the draft guidance, they'll test it against these standards. In the course of testing it, they'll learn more about the draft guidance, go back and improve the draft guidance. And then any actual improvements to those 2 standards themselves will go through the normal standard setting process. And then finally, I mentioned that another outcome of the principles of disclosure discussion paper was the question of which accounting policies to disclose, what are material accounting policies. And the staff will be coming back to the board after thinking a little bit more about whether there are opportunities to make improvements to the practice statement that we have on materiality, whether we can provide some additional examples that might provide preparers with some guidance on how to disclose those significant accounting policies. So that's the second leg of better communications. There's 2 more, if you'll bear with me. The third leg is a project on management commentary. Now this project, again, it addresses content of financial reports, but unlike PFS and unlike the Disclosure Initiative, we're now moving to content that is outside the financial statements rather than inside the financial statements. And what we're looking at here is updating our management commentary practice statement for developments in the environment and for some identified gaps or some identified problems, known problem areas with narrative reporting. The area, and what you can see with the circle on the right, is that one of the big areas that we'll be looking at is wider corporate reporting. However, wider corporate reporting is a very expansive field, including both public policy matters as well as those matters that focus on financial reporting themselves. And what the board has decided is to stick with its core competencies. We're looking to provide financial information that is going to be relevant to capital market actors. That's the key piece. The scope is going to be still within our remit. And what that means is providing guidance on disclosures related to a company's strategy or business model for long-term value creation, so things like intangibles, and how those strategies will have implications for the company's financial statements going forward. The other sort of aspiration associated with this project is addressing concerns about short-termism. So the idea here is that companies or investors, by looking at these additional or improved narrative disclosures, can get some insight into the company's long-term thinking and the extent to which, if at all, the company has ignored or deprioritized the long-term strategy for the benefit of short-term benefits. Now, I do know a number of you in this audience have been helping us with this project. We've reached out and we've gotten feedback on the regulations in your jurisdictions, as well as some updates in your jurisdiction. So thank you very much for providing that feedback, and we look forward to analyzing that and having it feed into our thinking in the project in the future. And then the final piece of better communications is IFRS taxonomy, and as I mentioned, this piece relates to the delivery of financial content rather than the content itself. And I have to admit, I don't know if others of you are like me in this regard, but in the US, I was at the Securities and Exchange Commission when the US GAAP taxonomy was mandated about a decade ago. And as a hardcore technical accountant, I just did not want to listen. My eyes would go off in another direction, my mind would go off in another direction, because the taxonomy seems like this abstract technological thing. However, after a few years of forcing myself to get into it, I would encourage all of you to spend some time in this area, because I am convinced that the taxonomy is the future, and it's part and parcel with what we do as standard setters. And so it's very important for us to learn and understand the implications of the taxonomy. And the reason for that is that the IFRS taxonomy is really just providing a structure. It's providing labels for users to be able to consume those financial reports electronically. And we have evidence that users are more and more consuming those that financial information using electronic means. We also know that in the US, the SEC has now mandated use of the IFRS taxonomy. So that's about 500 foreign private issuers, trillions upon trillions of dollars of market cap that are going to be reporting using the taxonomy. Europe is moving along as well. In 2020, they will be using the IFRS taxonomy as well. So this is the future. And the challenge here is that even though there's significant benefits for using and consuming financial data, for analyzing and manipulating the data in more efficient ways, if what is being consumed by investors is disconnected from however great our recognition and measurement and presentation and disclosure standards are, then the capital markets are going to be affected. So we can do the best job as standard setters with actually issuing those standards, but if something happens to sort of pollute or distort what's actually being consumed by the end user, we're going to have problems. So in my mind, this is quite key for the future of standard setters. And what we as an organization are doing to help with that issue, there are a number of things, including educational material to help with implementation for preparers and regulators, as well as, and I referred to this earlier, providing common reporting practice tags or labels. So one example is what we're doing on IFRS 13. Our staff spent quite a bit of time taking a look at IFRS 13 disclosures that went above and beyond what's required in the standard. And to the extent that there were commonalities or themes, they've made proposals to amend or update the IFRS taxonomy. And the benefit of doing that is that it provides structure for preparers. For those additional voluntary disclosures, there's now a structure so that one company's disclosures can be easily compared to another company's disclosures. You don't have a situation where each company is just sort of doing its own thing and then the user is left with non-comparable information. So again, I encourage you to take a look at that proposed taxonomy update and a number of other documents that will be issued in the near future. And with that, I'll move on. We'll move on to active projects, and Peter will start off with regulated activities.
Thanks, Neely, and good morning, everybody. As we're among standard setters, I'll start off with a definition, I think. You might wonder what we mean by active projects. So active projects is the label for a section of our website. It combines the research projects and the major standard setting projects. So I'm going to talk about some of those. We have a separate section on implementation projects, and Henry's going to talk about those in a few minutes. So the active projects we've got, Neely's just talked about the first batch. I'm going to talk about the next three, and then I'm going to hand over to Kumar, who's going to talk about the last three that are on that slide. So rate-regulated activities, and what's going on here? This is a project we've been working on for a little while, and in fact, we had a very good discussion with you last year, and you gave us some very valuable input, which we've been working on through the year. Just to remind you a bit of what the problem here is, this is a relationship that has three parties in it. There's the supplier, the customer, and the regulator. And our existing standards deal quite well with the relationship between the supplier and the customer. That's the right-hand part of that slide. It's covered by IFRS 15, for example. But they don't deal particularly well with some aspects of the relationship between the supplier and the regulator. And having dug into this a bit, we think the main problem is really what we've been calling timing differences, which is when there are events that cause some income or expenses in one period, and then that has a knock-on effect to the amounts that the entity is able to bill in future periods. So to give an example, let's say that you're in a model that says there's a regulatory agreement that says that you can bill cost plus, I don't know, 5% or some profit margin like that. And your estimate, what you bill the customer this year, is based on your estimate of what your costs are going to be. And let's say you have some input cost variance. So let's say your costs are going to be 100 currency units more than you expected when you set your price for this year. Well, in the future, the regulatory agreement means that you're going to be able to adjust your pricing to try and recover that 100. So you've got a right to recover, to bill an extra amount in the future with the aim of trying to recover that 100. And what this project is trying to deal with is how to deal with rights or obligations to adjust the future price that you can set because of these timing differences. So that's basically what this project is focusing on. To tie this to the theme of a lot of today's meeting, the board used the conceptual framework to analyze these rights and obligations and satisfied itself that they do meet the definition of assets and liabilities. And then another important question it looked at was the question of units of account, because these particular rights and obligations are embedded in the regulatory agreement. Now, apart from this, these particular rights and obligations arising from timing differences, the board felt that the existing standards were perfectly adequate to deal with the rest of the regulatory agreement. And so what the board is doing is treating the rights and obligations that arise from the timing difference as a separate unit of account, and we're accounting for those. To sort of put it in simple terms, they're a bit like receivables and payables. They're not exactly receivables and payables, but they're close enough that accounting for them separately seems to make some sense. So we're working towards either a discussion paper or an exposure draft. I think the staff are likely to recommend moving towards an exposure draft, but the board hasn't yet had that discussion, and we're aiming to publish a document next year. The next project I want to pick up is business combinations under common control. These are scoped out of the business combination standard IFRS 3 at the moment, and it's a common problem how to deal with these. Now, when you talk about this, it's important to understand which set of financial statements we're talking about. What we're talking about are the financial statements of the company that acquires the business. It's not the top parent or the ultimate controlling party or the controlling party for both parties of the company, and it's not the company that's been acquired. It's the acquirer in that transaction. The others are already covered by the existing standards, but it's that that acquiring company that's the focus of this discussion. In practice, a lot of these are accounted for using a predecessor method, so using some sort of carry-forward basis. There seems to be a general consensus that not all transactions should be accounted for using the predecessor method. Probably some should and some shouldn't. And so a lot of the discussion has been trying to focus on when we should use some sort of predecessor method and when we should use something else. The board's discussions over the last few months have focused on cases where there are some non-controlling interests in that acquiring company, at the level of that acquiring company. And the basic idea there is that if you're thinking of a normal business combination and the information that the users need is given by the acquisition method, then it seems sensible that the non-controlling interests in this type of transaction, that sort of information would also be useful to them. So those seem like candidates for something like the acquisition method or possibly some variance on it, and the board has been discussing a bit whether there should be some variance on it. The board is about to come to the discussion of cases where there's no non-controlling interest at that level. It seems likely that for at least some of those transactions, it will be some sort of predecessor method, and we've still got to have some further discussion of exactly what the predecessor method is, because there's a range of practice out there. So we're working towards most likely a discussion paper on that again over the next year or so. And the final one I want to pick up on is goodwill and impairments. Now, we've got a separate session on that later on, but let me just give you a few high-level points of that. The board's been discussing that fairly intensively for the last few months, and at the July meeting, it decided that it needed to sort of refocus its objectives for this work and identified three objectives. Objective A is about providing better information about the progress of the acquisition post-acquisition. How's it doing compared with the targets that management set when it was making the acquisition? And so we'll be exploring that. I'll move next to objective C, because that needs less background to understand, probably. So objective C is about making some improvements to the existing impairment test to take some cost out of the system. The board has identified a couple of things we can do there, removing some of the existing restrictions on the cash flows you can include, and looking at removing the requirement to use pre-tax cash flows. And then objective B is probably the one that's generated the most discussion. And to give you a bit of background on that, the board had been looking at whether we can make the impairment test much more effective. The board has ultimately concluded that any impairment test of goodwill is difficult and subjective, and it's not likely that we can make more than fairly marginal improvements. And so with that conclusion in mind, the board is going to look again at a couple of ideas that it had rejected about 8 or 9 months ago, which was looking at relief from the requirement to do a quantitative annual test and looking again at the question of amortization. Now, the board has not yet revisited either of those two questions, so it's too early to predict what the outcome will be, but we will be looking at that over the next few months. And there it looks as though we'll be heading towards a discussion paper because of the breadth and interconnection between the issues. So that's the end of our quick run through the active projects, and I'll now hand over to Kumar for the other active projects.
Thanks, Peter, and good morning, everybody. Okay, the technology is working. And thank you for being here. It's lovely to see the familiar faces and also the new faces. As Mary mentioned, if I'm up here, it has to be financial instruments. Well, you can guess I put a lot of weight on consistency. Just one point, Mary, I don't think financial instruments rule the world. I just think they are the most important. I'm sure everybody agrees with that. Okay. With that, let me just start off this morning to give you all an overview of what are the things that are keeping us busy at the moment. As Neely mentioned, we have issued IFRS 9, but there are a couple of other things that are still rumbling on. I have broken the presentation into three areas, which are the three primary areas that we are focusing on, which, as has been mentioned, is financial instruments with characteristics of equity, dynamic risk management, and last but not the least, IBORs, or interbank offer rates, or risk-free rates, the replacement of which is coming up. And just a point, it affects almost all jurisdictions because in some form or the other, the regulators are considering it. The other point to note, all three, as of now, are research projects. So they are on the research agenda, depending upon like how we get the feedback and what is the analysis done, it can come onto the standard setting agenda. We are also looking at some of the, what we call, maintenance issues, which come up with IFRS 9, and Henry will look after those, will speak about those. Okay, the first, of course, is financial instruments with characteristics of equity. As Hans put up, we issued this in June. It's a discussion paper and has got a 180-day comment period. It expires in January next year, and we are love to get your views on the discussion paper. It deals with the classification of financial instruments from the perspective of the issuer. So, as Hans put it, it asks the question, is that how do we determine what is an equity instrument, and how do we determine what is a financial liability? It does not look at the holder's perspective. That's covered by IFRS 9, which addresses different set of problems. So this is a project that looks at what is there currently in IAS 32. So having said that, what are we looking at and why are we looking at this project now? Now, those of you who can remember that far back, you remember the standard was issued in 1995. Things have moved on a little bit since then. New products have come in, new concepts have come in. And as you'll know, in the world of financial instruments, we love our jargon, so the ATF, the additional tier one capital structures, the new regulatory structures are coming in. It is time for an upgrade. So what the board is doing is looking at how is the best way to progress, keeping in mind that time's moved on, new structures have come in, and there are some challenges with IAS 32. But having said that, IAS 32 works well for most financial instruments. And this is borne out by the fact that during the financial crisis, it held up, and it held up quite well. However, there's limited information available to investors when something's put on inequity. And this has been a consistent message that we have been hearing across the board from investors, that if something gets classified as equity, I lose a lot of the information. And those of you who deal with IAS 32, it's got a famous rule, fixed for fixed. Now, when I was in practice, one of the big things I learned is that when you come to the context of 32, that's when you realize that fixed can have so many different meanings. And this is what has been also one of the things picked up by IFRIC, where there have been certain instances where the IFRIC could not reach a conclusion, not because of anything else, but because 32 does not always provide a clear rationale for the classification outcomes. So why are we putting this? Why does fixed for fixed work in these circumstances? So keeping these objectives in mind, what the board decided to do was actually articulate the principles that drive the classification outcomes without fundamentally changing those outcomes from 32. It is critical that we keep this objective in mind. That's what we have tried to do. And one of the key feedback we would like to get from you all is that, have you achieved that? Because whenever you change concepts or anything, it's the fringes that we need to be aware of to see if that's the classification outcome we were intending to change. Some of them, yes, but not major changes from the classification outcomes in 32. The other part, which is critical, and you can tell when you look at the discussion paper with the emphasis and focus that's been put, is on the disclosure elements and presentation elements that come out. And it addresses the key concern that investors have had that once things are put in equity, we lose the information content goes away. And that's one of the reasons why if you talk to investors, there's still some of them are pushing for what is called a narrow equity approach, saying that only simple shares should be in equity and nothing else. Now, that's a difficult place to get to. So one of the things that this discussion paper tries to do is address that concern through additional presentation and disclosure requirements. And we have put two chapters in the discussion paper quite separately on these two. So, having said that, what is the board's preferred approach to classification? Before we go into all the technical words, and I'm looking at an audience who love this and understand this, let me try and see if I can articulate the basic principle that we have used, or the board has used, to define what's a financial liability. And the first question we ask is, can the issuer be required to pay cash or hand over another financial asset to settle that instrument? Do you have to write a check if somebody else asks you to? If so, it feels like a debt instrument, and it will be one of the characteristics used to classify what we call a financial liability. The second is that, yes, you might be required to pay cash or hand over, but does the instrument require you to pay a return which has nothing to do with your performance? So, for example, whether you do well or you do badly, you still have to pay a fixed amount or a return on that instrument. Sounds very much like an interest rate. If that is the case, then again, this is the return feature, as we call it, that is a debt instrument. So fundamentally, if I look at it, what we have said is that if you have to pay out cash or to transfer something, or if you have to pay a return that is independent of your performance, i.e. has nothing to do with how well or how badly you do, you have to pay it out, then it's a financial liability. Otherwise, it's an equity instrument. Any of these two features will trip you into a financial liability classification. Turning that into the grid, which is also there in the discussion paper, is what we have turned this into when we look at what are the two features that drives classification. On the top side, it says, contains an obligation for an amount independent of the entity's available economic resources, i.e., you have to give a return irrespective of how well you perform. If your assets have gone up or have gone down, or your profits have gone up or not, it doesn't matter. You still have to pay that return. That's what we have tried to capture through that description of contains an obligation for an amount independent. And of course, contains no obligation for an amount independent of the entity's available economic resources. And on the left-hand side, requires the transfer of economic resources or doesn't require the transfer of economic resources. As I mentioned previously, any one of these two characteristics will trip you into a liability classification. So the only box that ends up being equity is the right-hand box, because you don't have an obligation for a return and you don't have to transfer resources before liquidation. So that fundamentally, ladies and gentlemen, is what's driving the debt equity classification principles. Now, of course, in reality, things get a lot more complex, and we will have to deal with that complexity, because some instruments, what are generally called hybrids or compounds, seem to behave like both. It behaves like a debt instrument for a while. It also behaves like an equity instrument for a while, depending upon circumstances. And the DP addresses these circumstances as well, quite very much in detail. But the fundamentally for these types of instruments, what the DP does is goes on to complete the accounting questions that have come up through IFRIC without changing the fundamental accounting that you get under 32. As I said, this is a 50,000 feet overview. I'm not saying that I'll present the whole 150 pages of the discussion paper that's there. We have breakout sessions, which you're free to attend if you want to, where we will go through this in much more detail. The other part that I mentioned is on presentation and disclosure. Now, if you look at this same grid, what we have done is broken it up on the right-hand side, that there are two separate disclosure elements coming in. Now, if you remember, I said any one of the features that I presented in the previous grid can make you into a liability. So you might not have any obligation to transfer cash or other resources until liquidation, but you are giving a return that is like a debt instrument, and that also makes you a liability. And in the other side, you can have one that requires transfer but does not give a return, or the return is like an equity instrument. So, as I said, these instruments can be mixed and matched. In dealing with the disclosure side of things, what the red box does is that it accepts that these are two different types of returns and requirements, and all are clubbed as liabilities. So it breaks that up and proposes to present these separately, not only on the balance sheet, but also in the profit and loss, because if it's a liability, it becomes P&L, the changes. And the last bit, which is there on equity, addresses the key concern that investors have had, that once things are put in equity, you lose the information content. So we have derivatives on own equity classified as equity, which are not remeasured. There's very little information present at the moment on such instruments. So what that does is that it looks at different ways of how to give additional information on things that are classified as equity instruments. Again, we will go through in detail on what are the details of the proposals in the breakout sessions. I have targeted the areas where the board has and would really like to get your feedback on the disclosure, the presentation, because there are various alternatives considered. It's not always that it's a single preliminary view that's been given. On the classification, yes, that's a preliminary view. In disclosures, we have quite a few questions where we are asking for input. So please do have a look at the discussion paper and let us know what you think, not only from a conceptual point of view, but what you're hearing from the operational aspects, because it does bring in additional requirements. Okay. Moving on to the world of dynamic risk management. Now, what are we trying to deal with in dynamic risk management? It is a project which deals with management of interest rate risk on amortized cost assets and liabilities. This is something which is done on a portfolio basis and is done dynamically, or these portfolios are changed on a regular basis. And currently, this is addressed by the model which is macro fair value hedge accounting for interest rate risk. What the project is trying to do is improve the information that's provided for such activities, because there's limited information provided as of now. And also, it's trying to see how best to capture these activities in the financial statements, trying to focus more on risk management. Let me put it down immediately that the objective is not to reflect risk management completely, but to get it as close as possible, given the fact that we are in the world of financial instruments, accounting. And we have looked at both measurement and disclosure. It is not just a disclosure-only project. It looks at both measurement and disclosure. Now, where are we in the project? I'll go through what those things mean, but the board has discussed the asset profile, target profile, and I'll cover them just now. What are the derivatives that will go into the risk management? And when we did the slides, we said performance assessment is current stage. We had a major session in September where we took about 60 to 70 pages to the board on what will be the performance, or how does the P&L and balance sheet look. And I'm glad to say we have got the decisions we need, and that's done. So that's where we are in the project timeline-wise. And there are a couple of things we need to close. And Neely mentioned that we are looking at this in a slightly different way when we do outreach. We are going to seek feedback on what is called the core model. There are always frills and other things that need to be added on as we go through to look at additional complications and other things. But given not only the inherent complexities of the area, but also the operational complexities that are associated with the area, the board's decided to develop just the core elements of the model first, which will be the engine of the model, go and get feedback on that engine, and then start working on the additional areas or the additional complexities. Simply because that there's no point trying to develop something if the engine doesn't work and we start adding frills to it later. So that is quite a departure from our normal process, and that's where we are, we will be doing once we have finished deliberations on the core version. And there are a couple of steps more, but not far away. So what is the project trying to do? When I talk about the asset profile, essentially it's your assets. What this means are those assets that's giving rise to your interest rate income in your books. These are the assets that lead to interest rate cash flows. And very loosely speaking, this is not very different from what would be your hedged item in a normal hedge accounting relationship. So what you're trying to do is manage the cash flows, interest rate cash flows, that are coming from the assets that you own. But you also have financial liabilities that you need to consider, because here's the key difference. What this project looks at is a net position, the net of interest income and interest expense, because that's what people are trying to manage through risk management. And that element is covered through what we call the target profile. Again, loosely speaking, using general cash flow hedging terms or hedge accounting terms, you have a floating rate asset, which is giving you floating rate interest payments. You want to convert it into fixed rate. So your target is a fixed rate asset, because that's what you're trying to get to. And that's what the target profile does, keeping in mind your liabilities. And the key element out here is that this project addresses the challenge banks faced with handling core demand deposits. And one of the key pivots of the project is how we look at core demand deposits. And putting it simply, when you have set a goal, which is your target profile, and you have your assets, which you are trying to change, and you have used derivatives that do it perfectly, that's when you have achieved what we call perfect alignment. So you wanted to move from floating rate assets to fixed rate. You used a fixed to floating swap, which perfectly matches those cash flows. And that's when you have perfect alignment and the performance picks it up. And what it says is that you defer the changes in fair value in OCI and release it to P&L, like in all cash flow hedge mechanics, when your interest cash flows come. So, fundamentally, this is taking the principles in line and extending them to look at portfolios that are dynamic and clearly looking at how do we handle core demand deposits, which is at the end of the day might be zero rates, but still a fixed rate liability, which is managed for risk management purposes. There's a bit more to be discussed in DRM, as to say. So if you are interested, and this is a space that is important for your jurisdictions, please watch this space. You will get a bit more, because the objective of this is to give better information on risk management activities. And one key element that's left for discussion is presentation and disclosure. Okay, continuing on the theme of interest rate risk, this is more a heads up on what we are calling interbank offer rates, IBORs, or different jargons, RFRs, risk-free rates. Just quickly, I think people are aware that in quite a few jurisdictions, after some of the challenges we have had with LIBOR and equivalent of rates being quoted and to some extent being managed, the regulators are coming in to change what will be the benchmark rate. So every instrument that refers to a benchmark rate, that's where the challenge is going to come in. And the last time the banks, some of the banks put a survey out, we are just talking about $170 trillion of assets around the world, excluding derivatives. What we are doing is that we are cognizant that this will have implications. Depending upon your jurisdiction and whether the regulators have decided to do this or not, you need to be aware that this could and will have significant accounting implications, especially in the area of hedge accounting. because what you're managing is interest rate risk, and that's defined in terms of the benchmark rate. We are cognizant of it. We are monitoring market developments because different jurisdictions are moving at different speeds. For example, UK is pretty advanced, so is the US. Europe is coming on board, and different jurisdictions are doing things to make it all the more fun differently. So please be aware that this is happening. If it is happening in your jurisdiction, this can have an accounting impact. Where we are is that we have got a research project on the agenda. We are looking at what the implications are. And hopefully, by the end of the year, we will report back to the board on the outcome of the research project with recommendations on what we think should be done from a standard setting perspective. So that's something you, again, need to watch out for, because it can creep up on us suddenly, and it will have implications. So to sum up, the three main areas where we are looking at is FICE, and please have a look at the document, and we would love to hear back from you. Dynamic risk management, which is, again, looking at interest rate risk in the banking book primarily, and if it is important for your jurisdiction, watch the space. And very importantly, last but not the least, interbank offer rates and what is happening in your jurisdiction. And if it is, once we start, we would love to hear from you, because everybody is doing it slightly differently, and we need to be aware so that we can think of what solutions will work. Okay, with that, I'll hand back again to Peter.
Thanks, Kumar. So I'm going to talk about the research pipeline and post-implementation reviews. So what's the research pipeline? That's something that the board set up after the last agenda consultation. It's a list of research projects that are not active at the moment, but the board expects to be able to work on and do at least most of the work on over the current agenda cycle, which runs through to 2021. This year, the board divided them into two categories, the ones it plans to start this year and ones that it plans to start next year or in early 2020. So the first five are ones that are starting up this year. Now, this slide now needs updating after the September board meeting, because the first two on that list have now become active. If you look at the website, they're now shown on the active program. So first of all, a project on extractive activities. That's to look at whether, or perhaps more accurately, how we replace IFRS 6, which was a temporary standard that's been around for a while. Secondly, a very narrow scope issue on pensions, looking at pension benefits that vary with returns on assets. It's a narrow scope project designed to look purely at removing a very well-known inconsistency. It's not planned to look at other aspects of pension accounting. For example, it's not planned to look at other aspects of what people sometimes call hybrid pension plans. Then the next three are still in the pipeline, but we expect to make them active in the next, before the end of the year. So provisions is a project that we've actually done probably 95% of the work on. That's looking at issues or possible issues with the provision standard IS 37, and the staff did a summary of the potential issues for the board about 3 years ago, but the final part of that project was waiting on the issuance of the revised conceptual framework, and so when this one starts up, the staff will do that last 5% of the project with the aim of recommending to the board whether or not to start a project to revise any aspects of IS 37. The next project is on variable and contingent consideration. That one is going to look at what happens when you buy an asset or a business and the consideration varies in some way. Our standards deal with some aspects of that, but they don't deal with all types of fact patterns, and there are one or two inconsistencies between some of the standards, and so we will look at those issues. Then finally, projects on SMEs that are subsidiaries. So the idea here is to see whether it's feasible to combine the disclosure requirements in the IFRS for SMEs standard with the recognition and measurement requirements in the full standards. The thinking behind that is that there are many listed companies that have subsidiaries where the subsidiary itself would qualify for the SME, but where it's not attractive for the SME to use the IFRS for SME standard, because they also have to produce information for the parent company that can be consolidated. And so what they would prefer would be to use the full recognition and measurement requirements, but to have a level of disclosure that's consistent with the level of disclosure in the IFRS for SMEs standard. Then the three projects that we plan to start up either next year or early the following year on the equity methods, on pollutant pricing mechanisms such as emission trading schemes, and on high inflation and whether it's feasible to desirable and feasible to expand the scope of IS29 to cover not just hyperinflation but also high inflation. I won't say any more on those three projects in the pipeline as they're not likely to become active for at least a few months yet. And then finally, I'll cover the post-implementation reviews. So this slide lists the various post-implementation reviews that we've either done or are planning to do. The left-hand column shows the ones where the PIR itself has been completed and that are ultimately resulting in no standard setting type activity. So on IFRS 8 on operating segments, we issued an exposure draft, I guess last year, and this year the board reviewed the responses and decided that some of the proposals weren't worth pursuing, and the remaining proposals, although the board still agreed with them, the board felt that they weren't enough of an improvement to be worth progressing to amendments to the standards at this stage. So the work on segments has now finished. On IFRS 13, so on fair value measurements, we completed the post-implementation review this year, and the main conclusion that from that was some disclosure issues to take forward, and the board is now taking those forward through the targeted standards level review that Neela mentioned earlier. It's one of the standards that's being targeted in that review. The middle column, IFRS 3 on business combinations, two standard setting projects came out of that. One was the project on goodwill and impairment that I mentioned a few minutes ago. And then secondly, there's a small project to amend the definition of a business and improve the guidance on definition of a business. And that's one that we'll be publishing this month, the final amendments to IFRS 3 on definition of a business this month. And then finally, either next year or again, perhaps early in the following year, the board plans to do two other post-implementation reviews, or the next two. These are on the what we like to call the consolidation standards, so the ones dealing with consolidation, associates, joint ventures, disclosure of interests in other entities, so IFRS 10, 11, and 12. And the second one is on IFRS 5, so on assets held for disposal, businesses held for disposal. And in both of those cases, as I said, we'll be planning to start up next year or early the following year. And with that, I'll hand over to Henry to talk about what we're doing to support implementation.
Well, thank you, Peter, and good morning, everybody. It's very good to have the opportunity to talk to you about our work supporting the implementation of our standards. So I often start with this slide. You may have seen it before. I think it's a good backdrop to the work that we do, and it really, to me, it emphasizes the importance that we attach to the work supporting the implementation and application of IFRS. And that's really because of the feedback that we got. Many stakeholders told us, you know, we should be doing more than just writing high quality standards. We have to play our part to ensure those standards are being applied in a consistent way so that users are getting the full benefit of IFRS as a single set of standards. And as Hans says, that's why over the last few years we have devoted significantly more resources to this area than previously, in particular significantly more resources to getting the standards off to a good start early in their life, and also I think using the Interpretations Committee more actively and making enhancements to its effectiveness and efficiencies. You may also have seen this slide before, but I think it's an important one, very much guides our work. The point I'm trying to make with this slide really is that we have to balance being helpful and responsive on the one hand, but obviously being very careful that we're not disruptive or undermining the principle-based nature of IFRS standards and going too far. And so that's why we've tended to provide more proactive educational support on the new standards in the early days compared with later. And that's because that's the time we can be most helpful without hindering the implementation process. And it's also why we always think very carefully, both the board and the interpretations committee, we weigh up carefully the need for standard setting when dealing with implementation questions. So with that background, I will turn to our work supporting the new standards. Now, of course, our newest standard is IFRS 17 on insurance contracts. We'll look at that shortly, but just to highlight, we are supporting that standard with a variety of the tools that you can see here. Now, with the other new standards, I think it's fair to say really the support has moved on from the implementation phase where we were pushing out educational materials like we were on leases IFRS 16 last year. You might say more to a business as usual phase of really stepping in as required and as requested, mainly through the interpretations committee, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. But we are still providing educational support as and when needed. So for example, just like to mention an important webcast we did on IFRS 9, and this was to respond to some concerns we were hearing in the marketplace about prepayable financial assets and the how the SPPI test in IFRS 9 was being applied. So we've posted a webcast on the website in June to sort of counter some of those views that we were hearing in the marketplace. And just to emphasize, all the materials that we've produced on the new standards in the last few years are on the website. Now, turning to IFRS 17, as Hans mentioned, it's now 16 months old, and of course it's our standard that brings much needed improvements to overhaul the very diverse accounting practices that exist around the world for insurance contracts. And this slide provides really an overview of the timeline since issuance through to the effective date of IFRS 17 in 2021. So you can see we're well now into the implementation phase, and linking back to what I just said earlier about the balancing act that we have to play, this is why we're now in the very active phase of our implementation support to try and get the standard off to a good start. I think it also a good reminder of the importance of good communication to the market of the impacts of the new standard. Very much heard that on some of the other new standards, people did leave that messaging about the impacts, for example, on IFRS 15, on IFRS 9, till rather late in the day. So that's an important point to keep highlighting. Now, we are aware of some concerns over the challenges of implementing IFRS 17 and the timetable for its implementation. And of course, we are monitoring companies' progress in this matter. Now, the board has not made any decisions about this, but what I can say is that the team working on IFRS 17 implementation have very much been collating all the information we've heard from our interactions with the industry and with the transition resource group, including concerns about the effective date as well. And the plan is to bring that to the board in October. Now, there will be no decisions in October. The board will effectively provide input onto how to progress this matter. So it's one to watch this space. As I said, no decisions yet. Meanwhile, as Hans was explaining, we have been doing many activities to support the standard, to support companies understand the new requirements and prepare for applying the standard. We've really used all the tools that we have in our toolbox on this. Hans mentioned the webinars and played you one. I just also like to highlight the fact that we've been doing a lot of education for the users of financial statements as well. We've held many meetings to help them understand the information and the impact of IFRS 17 compared to what they get today. And of course, we've also had set up the Transition Resource Group. Now, the Transition Resource Group is very much modelled on our previous experience with Transition Resource Groups on revenue and on the impairment of financial assets. As Han said, it's got a mix of people from large insurance companies, auditors and regulators. It's basically people who are very much steeped in IFRS 17 and its implementation. But the point of the TRG really is to have a very open and transparent process. Anybody can submit a question. All of the papers analysing those questions that go to the TRG are available on the website, and we post a summary of the meeting, including observations made by the TRG members subsequent to the meeting on the website. And of course, the meetings are public, they're webcast, and they're retrievable subsequently. Now, the TRG has met three times. I think so far it's received something like 81 submissions, and most of those questions have actually resulted in papers going to the TRG. Very few actually didn't meet the criteria for discussion at the TRG. The discussions at the TRG also helpful to the board to see if any action is needed with implementation. And so far, that has led us to identifying some very narrow scope and targeted annual improvements to the standard that will be exposed in due course. I think we're starting to see that the submissions are becoming much more detailed to specific transactions and contracts. So we have another meeting scheduled for December, but we are going to consider the number and the nature of the submissions that we have and will receive to confirm that meeting or decide whether to move it into early next year. So turning now to our support for standards in effect, I think the main tool here that we use is the Interpretations Committee. So we have here a slide with a summary of the Interpretations Committee's activities to date. You can see that this year we've continued to be busy. We've already considered 22 topics at the five meetings that we held. And particularly what I want to highlight, of course, is that the Interpretations Committee is responding to and answering the vast majority of the questions it receives with agenda decisions, mostly because it concludes that the standard provides an adequate basis for addressing the question. Now, personally, I continue to think that agenda decision, the name agenda decision, really undersells what these pieces coming out of the Interpretations Committee are. And that's because most of these agenda decisions contain really very helpful and informative information about applying the principles and the requirements in the standards to the particular scenario that's in the submission. And so the committee continues to work on trying to make this information as useful and as helpful as possible. So we continue to think agenda decisions are a really important tool for supporting high quality, consistent application of our standards. And we also think it's good that the market attaches importance to this, and that's why the due process around agenda decisions is important. Remember, these agenda decisions are exposed for comment before they're finalized. They're exposed for 60 days. Now, we have been focusing on the timeliness of the process over the recent months. And I think we were looking at some of the statistics around this. And what we've been managing to do is to get issues to the committee and to get the committee to sort of make the next step in the process at the first consideration of the issue. And I think we've achieved that something like about 90% of the time over the last 18 months or so. And I think that is contributing to getting the submissions just dealt with perhaps more efficiently and quickly than we have done in the past. And of course, that's really important when you're dealing with questions on the new standards. And talking of due process, I would just like to say a thank you to everybody in this room here. We really appreciate your support on the Interpretations Committee, from sending us questions, from commenting on our tentative agenda decisions, and also, very importantly, with the help you provide on the outreach when we're initially analysing the question before we take it to the committee. So please encourage your stakeholders to participate in the process as well. Now, we've got breakout sessions which will delve into some of these topics in a little bit more detail later on today and early tomorrow. But what I wanted to flag was, in the 14 agenda decisions with explanatory material that you can see on the slide here, there are agenda decisions providing very helpful information about the requirements in IFRS 15 and IFRS 9. So on IFRS 15, the agenda decisions are, I think, providing very helpful information about key steps, key new steps in the standard on identifying performance obligations and figuring out is the revenue recognised over time or point in time. And the one on IFRS 9 really emphasises the new requirement that went into IS 1 about presenting interest revenue, and it really emphasises that the interest revenue required there is the interest revenue that comes from financial assets on which the effective interest method, and it applies only to the financial assets that are measured at amortized cost or fair value through OCI. I'll mention one other topic on here because I saw a question had come in on cryptocurrencies, and that's to highlight in the topics there where it says three committee provided feedback on proposed amendments. One of those actually was a very recent committee discussion on cryptocurrencies. Now, the board and the committee have not made any decision on this so far, but the committee did consider how IFRS standards would be applied today when you're holding cryptocurrencies or in the case of initial coin offerings as well. And that'll be reported back to the board probably later this year for the board to decide if it wants to do any standard setting or how it wants to respond to the questions. I know it's a very hot topic, the whole question of cryptocurrencies. Just for completeness, we've given you the slide of the amendments that we've made to the standards and issued over the last year. I'm not going to talk to that. But also for completeness, here is the list of maintenance projects that we have ongoing. Again, I don't want to talk to all of these, but maybe I just flag a couple on here. First of all, the one at the very top, this is the amendments to IFRS 3 business combinations. You recall this is a project that came out of the post-implementation review that we undertook, and this will be issued very shortly. So these amendments will clarify the definition of business and hopefully reduce the diversity interpretations around that. And then the other one I wanted to flag was later this year, we will be issuing a very targeted exposure draft proposing amendments to IAS 37 around the definition and identifying an onerous contract. This is to reduce diversity in interpretations about when is a contract onerous. And this one has become more important because with IFRS 15 superseding IAS 11, the specific requirements that used to apply for onerous construction contracts were withdrawn, and they're now accounted for under IAS 37. So there have been questions about how do you actually read the words in IAS 37. So watch out for that exposure draft towards the end of the year, and we look forward to your input on that. Now, I've mentioned the website a few times this morning. Wanted to highlight that all the materials that we produce that relate to supporting the standards are on the website, agenda decisions, TRG materials, webcasts. They're all on the supporting implementation web pages, which is a direct link from the home page. And here, for example, I've got the example of the type of materials that you'd see for IFRS 9. But I am aware from talking to various people that people aren't as aware of perhaps as we would like them to be, and perhaps we need to work on this more, particularly of where agenda decisions can be found. So I did want to do a sort of like an interactive demonstration, but I was a bit nervous about the Wi-Fi. So I pre-recorded a demonstration, which I hope is going to work, of how to find agenda decisions. And there are two ways that you can get to agenda decisions on our website. So the first is a chronological list. So from the home page, you click on supporting implementation at the top, and that takes you to our supporting implementation page, and then click on how the IFRS Interpretations Committee helps implementation. This takes you to explanation about the Interpretations Committee, and then click on agenda decisions. You get a full list of all the agenda decisions in chronological order. So that's the first way that you can get to agenda decisions. The second way is you can see them organized by standard or by interpretation, in other words, the relevant standard or relevant interpretation. Now again, you click from the home page on the supporting implementation tab, but this time you click on supporting materials by IFRS standard and IFRIC interpretations. And then for this list, I'm selecting IFRS 15. You get a complete list of the standards. So I'm selecting IFRS 15, no surprises. And then from here, you get all of the materials supporting IFRS 15. You can see there's a link then to agenda decisions. And there are the three agenda decisions so far on IFRS 15. And there's the agenda decision. So that's how you find the agenda decisions. But also, and I know this is a way practitioners find very helpful, all the agenda decisions are included in context, in the relevant part of the standards, in the annotated IFRS standards. Now, you'll recall we used to have a green book. I actually remember Peter asking about a few years ago, did people know what the green book was, and offering prizes to those who did. But we've reconfigured this year to make our annotated version of the standards much more useful and practical. So they're now at the 1st of January, and we have a red and a blue version. The blue version is for all the standards that are in effect. The red is obviously all the standards that have been issued. The blue was printed as well. The red, I think, is about to be printed as well, because it's proved very, very popular. So I think this is a really useful way of seeing agenda decisions, and also they contain quite a lot of cross-referencing as well to navigate your way around the standards and the links to the illustrative examples and the basis for conclusions. So I wanted to flag that. And then finally, I'm just conscious of the time here, wanted to say a few words about the IFRS for SME standard. As I'm sure you're aware, one of the aims of us having this standard was to reduce the burden on stakeholders by limiting the amount of change to the standard. So instead of having constant updates and changes to the standard, we committed ourselves to a process of periodic reviews. Now, we completed the first full comprehensive review of the SME standard in 2015. Those amendments became effective, I think it was last year. And what I wanted to flag is that our plan is to start the second review next year. So that will be the second review of the SME standard. It's going to be an important one, because clearly in the time between the last review and this one, we've issued some pretty major new standards. We also have the IFRS for SMEs implementation group as well. Just to remind you, that still exists. Its materials are on the website. And of course, I just wanted to flag that they produced a Q&A on financial guarantee contracts at the end of last year, which, as I said, is on the website. And then finally, I wanted to highlight that we're in the process of developing and updating a comprehensive guide to support stakeholders using the IFRS for SME standards. The final guide will have 35 modules and around 2,000 pages of content. Each of the modules will have the complete text of the standard, and each paragraph of the standard is annotated with helpful commentary and examples. And there's various other materials in those modules as well, but it's a really useful guide to understanding the RFRS for SME standard. Now, so far, we have 15 of those planned 35 modules on the website, and we're really working hard to get the rest of them out over the next 6 months. And they're free, freely available on our website, and we can also license them for translation. So if that's something that you're interested in, please talk to Matt Tilling or the TAC team as well. So that's all I wanted to highlight about our work supporting implementation and the SME standard. And thank you for your time, and I'm going to hand back to Neely.
Thank you, Henry. So we're almost there. Coffee break is just around the corner. I've promised Mary that I won't take any more than 2 minutes here to talk about the technology initiative. This is a cross-cutting effort at the organization to very fundamentally think about the question of how does technology affect the financial reporting world, and how does it affect us as standard setters? And what we're doing in this space, first and very importantly, is monitoring developments. The world is changing very quickly, so we're keeping our eye out on what's going on. And then scoping with those developments what actually relates to us as standard setters and financial reporting, and then maybe what's a little bit outside the scope. Maybe preparers or auditors might care more about it, but not necessarily us. Then from there, developing a strategy and then executing on that strategy, which would be an iterative process because, again, as we monitor and as we learn more about these technological developments, our strategy and the execution of necessity will need to shift. Having said that, though, we expect that there are really four main work streams that will go into this technology initiative. The first is accounting itself, so things like accounting for crypto assets, other sorts of different technological developments that may need additional guidance if it's not already contemplated within our standards. The second, and I think the most significant piece, is going to be the consumption of financial reports. As I mentioned before, users are moving more and more towards digital consumption of financial reports. So what does that mean for us? Is there still a role for structured data? If so, what role is the IFRS taxonomy going to play? Or in the extreme, are we going to be living in a world where, say, artificial intelligence sort of obviates the need for structured data? Moving on to the third work stream, the standard setting process, here we're looking at things like, can we use technology to improve our access to data so that we have more evidence-based standard setting? How can we use technology to make our work processes more efficient? So analyzing comment letters, even obtaining comment letters from the outside, as well as drafting our standards. So thinking about the world more so from, or less so from a two-dimensional piece of paper, but more so from digital consumption. So maybe in the future, we don't need to worry so much about the location of disclosures, the location of financial information. It doesn't matter if it's in the footnotes or on the face. As another example, maybe the size of a piece of paper doesn't matter as much. So today you might hear arguments about, well, if we put that on the face of the P&L, we're going to have a very long income statement. Or if we put something in a footnote disclosure on segments, well, it's going to be a lot of segment information on a piece of paper. But in a digital world, maybe those sorts of questions don't matter as much. And then finally, the last work stream is stakeholder engagement. So this is thinking about technology and improving how we interact with our stakeholders through it, webcasts, video conferences, social media, as well as the accessibility of our standards through EIFRS and possible ways of making it more accessible or easier to access and digest the technical standards that we have. And with that, Mary, I am all finished.
Thanks very much to everybody. Let me just give you a rundown on how we're going to wrap up this morning. I'm going to just ask one question from each of our panelists on the update session. Then we're going to have a coffee break. I'm going to ask you to be back from the coffee break at 25 past because we're going to do catch up on the Slido questions, also the evaluation for this session. And then we're going to have one more plenary before lunch, and then a second one after lunch. Then we're going to go into the first breakouts, testing application, exercising your muscles as standard setters, testing application of the conceptual framework before we go into the normal carousel. And you'll see, looking at the agenda, that the carousel of five at the end of the day today is repeated tomorrow, so you'll be able to do two. Each of you will be able to do two of the five. They're mostly about current projects, and as Henry mentioned, there's one also about the interpretation committee's activities. So that's how we're running the rest of the day today. I'm going to also give you the heads up that if you'd prefer to work with Slido as an app, there's one available from the app stores, so you can get to it that way. And with all that admin taken care of, let me rocket through a few questions. Now, without having warned you, so this isn't quite fair, I'm going to, Henry, start with you and just ask you for a comment about what we're hearing about implementation of both 9 and 15, and thinking about some mutterings I've heard, disclosures about IFRS 16. Any messages that you want to pass on to people?
That's quite a big question, Mary, but I think companies have got on with their implementation. I think some companies wish that they'd started earlier, and I actually heard something recently that highlighted that perhaps lessons have been learned, and that actually IFRS 16 implementation in some cases actually more advanced than IFRS 15 implementation. However, I think that the key thing that I'm highlighting at the moment is really around disclosure. And I think it's an area where all of us need to do our part to make sure that we do get the benefits from the new standard, because disclosure was an important part of the package here. Because one of the things I am hearing from some user meetings I attend is that on some of the early examples they've seen is a little bit of disappointment about the specificity of the disclosure. It can sometimes tend towards the boilerplate. So I think it's just something that we all need to watch and remind people that we wrote objective-based disclosure requirements to allow companies to tell a very company-specific, business model-specific story, not to effectively yield generic disclosures. So I think it's just something where I feel regulators will probably put some focus on, and it's something that we'll have to watch too. But if you're doing any talking about the new standards, anything you can do to remind people about the importance of disclosure would be much appreciated.
Yeah. And Henry, maybe if you don't mind, I'm going to add a comment or two on that. One is just confirming that those comments you are making are about disclosures within the standard rather than the requirement to disclose the expected impact of published but not currently effective standards. And the second, I think very important, that this is that 9 and 15 are in some ways test runs of more objective-based disclosures. And I think we'll certainly be looking at the experience and the feedback we get in those as we look in our Principles of Disclosure project about how far we go with objectives-based disclosures. So maybe start connecting the dots on that for people as well. Peter, there are a couple of questions that have come in via Slido. Thumbs up to those who have started using it. One is about rate regulated, and why is it not a revised discussion paper, but rather an exposure draft? Maybe if I ask you to comment on that, but maybe also just comment generally about research projects and how far they go and what we do if we decide as a board that we are not going to undertake standard setting.
Okay, thanks. So I'll take the specific one on rate regulation first. So a reminder, first of all, the board hasn't yet discussed whether it should be a discussion paper or an exposure draft, but as I said, the staff's leaning is towards recommending an ED. I think there are two main reasons for that. The first is we had a meeting with our rate regulation consultative group towards the end of last year, and I think that persuaded us that it doesn't look as though there'll be major implementation issues that are likely to arise. And then the second factor is that I think where a discussion paper works well is where you want broad-based input on quite a wide-ranging discussion, possibly on a range of alternatives. I think the way the model has been developing, we're looking at a much more focused and targeted model now, and I think we won't need that kind of broad-based input to the same extent as it might have appeared perhaps a year or two ago. So an ED to us probably looks like a more efficient way of getting, and more effective way of getting the input we need. On research, research projects here, so the board does research to find out whether it should do a standard setting project. And basically it's trying to ask three questions. Is there a problem? Is the problem big enough that we need to consider doing some standard setting? And do we think it's actually feasible to find a solution? I think when the research program was first set up, people's expectation, the board's expectation and the staff, was that we would probably end up publishing some sort of document towards the end, seeking more public feedback. I think we've now come to realize that that's not necessary in every case. In some cases, it will be necessary. So, for example, I wouldn't be that surprised if we did it on, well, Goodwill, for example, looks like the way forward is to do a discussion paper at the next stage. But in other cases, I think the board feels that there wouldn't really be any benefit in seeking further public input, and that would just impose burdens on respondents for no good reason. And so I think the board is taking a case-by-case decision when it gets at the end of the research project. Does the board have enough information to decide, yes, we should move towards standard setting or no? And if the board's inclination at that stage is not to do standard setting, it's a separate question whether we should try and get some kind of formal input on that. Bearing in mind the board will have already collected some input during the course of the research.
Peter, thanks very much. Kumar, I'm going to ask you a question specifically about the dynamic risk management. And you talked about the core model and kind of a two-stage consultation. Can you just give people a better feel for whether that's going to be a private or public consultation, how it might run?
Sure, Mary. As I mentioned, it is a new way the board is considering how to do it, because what we are looking at is, before we start adding the bells and whistles on the complexities and everything, is determined whether the engine of the model works. It will not be a due process document, because that's a formal process. What exactly will be the format, we haven't discussed with the board as yet, and we will certainly come back, but it will certainly be a public consultation where we talk to the people publicly on their views on what the core model is going to be, and what their views are also on whether we should progress it to the next level to develop a fully fledged model. But it will also, let me emphasize, not be a due process document, as we call it, like a discussion paper or an exposure.
Okay. Thanks. And then before I give Neely a last and very fast shot, I just want to comment on one of the things that Henry mentioned, because we've had seven people emphasize the question about reporting digital assets. If you are interested in this subject and following it closely, let me strongly recommend to you the paper that was discussed by the Interpretation Committee at its September meeting, which recaps the thinking the board has done to date and asks the Interpretation Committee for advice. That advice is, I think, it might just be very high-level reported in IFRIC update. But as Henry said, watch that space for the staff reporting back to the board later this year. But I think that paper that went to the Interpretation Committee is a very good recap of the work that the staff has done so far. So, Neely, we have a specific question here about principles of disclosure and why not publish the seven principles. I'll give you a choice of answering that, or we can toss it to this afternoon session, or just asking you for your reflections on a year at the ISB.
Could I do both? I'll be
no.
Really fast.
No,
oh,
one.
Okay. We'll toss the first question on the principles to the afternoon session, because I would like to end on a very positive note about my reflections over the past year. There have been two things that have really struck me in being here. The first is how much work this small group of people does over the course of any period of time. So we have 150 people, 80 of whom are on the technical staff. They are responsible for supporting and developing standards for 144 countries, outreach with all of the stakeholders in all of those countries, the variety of views that come out of that, the research, the analysis, the deliberations, the feedback loops after we do the outreach, taking things to the board, the drafting, it's absolutely incredible. We have a very dedicated, hardworking, talented group of staff, and I do encourage you during the breaks and lunch to speak with them. And the other piece that has really struck me is how engaged all of our stakeholders are. And today is a perfect example. You all have busy schedules, you all have limited resources, and yet you've taken the time to come here and join us. That level of participation is so critical to us putting forth the highest quality standards. So thank you for your time, and please do continue to be involved in what we do going forward.
Okay. Neely, thanks. That's a great note to end on, but I'm going to lower the tone of the conversation with three things. One, could we be back here at 11:25 to kick off then? Because I wanted to pick up a couple minutes to finish off on the Slido questions. Second, if your dinner plans have changed, either you thought you weren't going to be able to join and you actually are going to be able, or something's happened and you signed up and you can't, please let Gloria or Carol know at the registration desk. And third, everybody monitor what we're doing to Henry's accent, because I swear that when he was talking about things that were scheduled, he still said scheduled, but it's starting to get harder and harder. So I think we're going to get that corrected in the next couple of years. See you back here at 11:25.